Hello and welcome to CIA Files, True Stories of U.S. Intelligence. I'm your host, Topher M. Ford. Got our co-host, Brandon Givens, currently trekking through Istanbul at the moment. Is that right, Brandon?
That is true.
Yep, so yeah, your audio is a little funny because I'm assuming in a hotel room or something.
I'm in a hotel restaurant, but I'm the only person in here right now, so yeah, that works out.
Awesome. How's the summer travels going?
So far, pretty good. We've been pretty much sleeping all day today. It rained, but we got here on the first, and we walked and walked and walked and walked, and we saw a whole lot of the city. We went and saw the Greek patriarch, and we kind of got off the beaten path, so down some neighborhoods, and we've had a lot of stray cats. That's been awesome, and stray dogs, and that's been like one of the best things is all the animals. And we fly off to Poland tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's interesting because we just got a new dog. A pit bull puppy named Luna. She's not puppy sized. She's, you know, kind of big, but she's going to get much bigger. But she has too much energy. Much too much energy. I'm too old. All right. Well, so today we are going to discuss the official CIA manual of trickery and deception. And I didn't plan this, but it's interesting because it vaguely sort of ties into some big news that happened recently, that being the assassination of the former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. He died on Friday. Today is Sunday, July 10th, by the way. But he died on Friday after being shot in the back while giving a campaign speech on the streets of Japan. And it's sort of related because the assassin, a 41-year-old man named Tetsuya Yamagami, used an improvised homemade gun because gun laws in Japan, you know, are much stricter than they are in America. So he built his own, and it is an insane gun that looks like it came out of a video game. And he apparently, this is according to CNN, Yamagami made multiple types of guns with iron pipes that were wrapped in adhesive tape, Japan's public broadcaster NHK reported, citing the police. The police found guns with 3, 5, and 6 iron pipes as barrels. The suspect inserted bullets into his handmade gun, parts of which he had bought online, police said. Police believe the suspect was using the strongest weapon he made in the assassination. And we won't get too much into the details of the assassination, but the gun, if you've seen pictures of it, yeah, it looks like it was out of... It reminds me of the Fallout video games, especially in New Vegas, where you'll see, you know, homemade, improvised stuff. It's an insane story. Even though we're not really covering current events anymore, we would be remiss not to mention this anyway, because it would be, I think, a comparable event... here in America might be if like George W. Bush was shot on the street while giving a speech, you know, it would be pretty crazy.
Yeah. I'm curious about his motivation. Yeah. I'm curious about the guy's motivation. I can't find anything myself yet.
Well, the reason that, I keep saying, so the Japanese police are being very stingy with information about it, but, they did say that he assassinated Abe because he believed that Abe was linked to a religious organization that kind of sucked his mother in. People are guessing, and it seems like the best guess is that it's the Unification Church, officially now known as the Family Federation for World Peace and Unification, otherwise known as the Moonies.
That sounds like the Moonies.
Yeah. Founded by Sun Myung Moon. We don't have near enough time to get into them. They're a crazy group. I think I could be wrong about this, so people can correct me if I am, but it sort of seems almost to be like analogous to hard right evangelicals here in America.
It is.
Although
it is.
I don't think they're Christians.
Well, I mean, saying they're not Christians is kind of like saying Mormons aren't Christian. And, you know, I mean,
I don't know a lot about the Moonies. I think that Christ and Christianity has worked into it. But yeah, I don't know enough about the Moonies other than
Mammon loves them.
Mammon loves.
Yeah, we can do a Mammon episode.
Violent creatures. We can circle back to the Moonies at some point, but the basic premise is that Yamagami's mother had, you know, given almost all of her money to this religious group that a lot of people consider a cult. And he believed that Shinzo Abe was a prominent member of that, of the religious group, and that's why he shot him. So, and at this point, it's kind of speculation, because like I said, the Japanese police are not forthcoming with too much information. So, it's a lot of people connecting dots, but it makes sense. It tracks.
It connects to the zygist we're seeing, like the blowing up of those stones in Georgia, and these elite people have a secret cult, and there's a lot of paranoia and misinformation, and people are being accused of being in groups that they're not in, but you know, so there's this whole, people are frustrated, scared, they don't know what to believe, and that's not working out very well.
No, it's not. It seems to be a bit of a global phenomenon, which is not great. It's kind of a bummer. But the whole reason a part of the reason why we stopped doing the current events is because it's big. It's been, all of it's a bummer. Yeah, so let's get into the official CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception. This is an interesting book. You can actually, I bought a physical copy of it, but you can go online, and we'll put a link up on the website, ciafiles.net, where you can go to archive.org and read the book, and I think download it for free if you are interested in it.
Public domain, yes.
It's a wild story. So the CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception is actually two manuscripts put together. The first one is called Some Applications of the Art of Deception, and then the other one was called Recognition Signals. These are two manuscripts that Sidney Gottlieb, if you don't remember, he was the doctor who was head of the CIA's technical services staff, which was, you know, the spy gadgets and secret devices research and development division of the CIA. So MK Ultra, if you have ever heard of that, I don't know if you have. I'm kidding. Everybody knows. Anyway, MK Ultra was authorized in April 1953. And Gottlieb immediately contacted renowned magician John Mulholland for help. Mulholland asked for $3,000 for the task, and it was approved in the budget as MKUltra subproject number 4 on May 4th, 1953.
So he was a magician?
Yes. John Mulholland wasn't so much a world-famous magician in the way you might consider, you know, like Harry Houdini or David Copperfield. He was an up-close magician. He was like a magician's magician. And he did most of his performances for, like, at parties and elite social gatherings. He also wrote extensively. He had a periodical that he published for magicians. And his expertise in up-close magic made him particularly appropriate for the task. Because unlike a stage magician, you know, stage magician's going to be have a big presentation. They're going to have big set pieces. And the whole idea for a stage magician is that everyone's attention is on them. CIA agents don't want that attention on them. So up-close magic, where you're, you know, like tricking people so that they don't see what you're doing, that was more appropriate for what CIA, you know, for what Gottlieb was looking for. You know, and this also, MK Ultra kind of in the early 50s marks this turn in American methodology for, you know, like how they approach intelligence work. We talked a little bit about that in previous episodes, how before World War II, the American government and the American military didn't like the idea of spying on people. You know, there's the famous quote, gentlemen don't read each other's mail. And then World War II, and then the subsequent rise of communism and the fear of communism started changing the Americans' minds. James H. Doolittle, he wrote a report for President Eisenhower in 1954, and it concluded, quote, if the U.S. is to survive, long-standing American concepts of fair play must be reconsidered. We must learn to subvert, sabotage, and destroy our enemies by cleverer, more sophisticated, and more effective methods than those used against us. It may become necessary that the American people become acquainted with, understand, and support this fundamentally repugnant philosophy. So that's where, you know, because the Americans in charge had this notion that the Russians, that the Soviets had no morals, that the Russians were willing to do absolutely anything in their conquest, in their search for world domination. And that led to a big shift in the thinking of the CIA. That's why we ended up with MK Ultra and all of the atrocities that were conducted under that label. You know, it marked the shift towards the ends justify the means thinking in the CIA and in the government in general.
Better dead than red.
Better dead than red, yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about the technical services staff, Gottlieb's organization within the CIA. They created lots of, you know, like the gadgets that you'd see in a James Bond movie. That's the stuff that they made. They made something called, they made a 22 caliber single shot gun, essentially, that was concealed inside a tube of toothpaste. There's the issue of President Patrice Lumumba in 1960, where they, you know, had plans to assassinate him that they eventually carried out. One of those plans was a tube of poisoned toothpaste that a CIA officer named Larry Devlin was supposed to put in Lumumba's toiletry kit. He eventually got cold feet and he tossed the tube of toothpaste, the poison tube, into a nearby river. That seems like a bad thing to do with a tube of deadly poison.
Yeah.
I mean, it's better than just, you know, tossing it in a trash can, I guess, but still. Yeah.
There's a perfectly good tube of toothpaste. Oh.
Yeah, it's just like one of the, we discussed this before when we talked about the heart attack gun, but one of the cyanide guns that the Soviets developed, the agent who was supposed to use it tossed it in a river. But then he defected and told the CIA about it, and they were able to fish it out. There are, of course, in our last episode on James Angleton, Part 3, we talked about or at least mentioned all the different plots that were proposed to kill President Castro, Fidel Castro in Cuba. We've got some of these listed in the book here. Hallucinogenic sprays and cigars. One chemist proposed spraying inside of Castro's radio broadcasting studio with LSD so that he would start to sound crazy while he was addressing the people. They also wanted to try to contaminate.
Well, we know that doesn't work.
Yeah.
when someone has the support of a certain crowd, it doesn't matter what gibberish they speak, and people will not change their mind. They're like, oh.
Yeah. This one is, all of these are pretty wacky. I mean, it really seemed to be like just a free-for-all, you know, like, no bad ideas, guys. No bad ideas. Let's just have them all. Somebody proposed contaminating his boots, because a lot of times when Castro traveled, he would leave his boots outside his hotel room so that they could be shined. Someone suggested spraying or dusting the inside of his boots with thallium salts, which would cause his beard to fall out.
Aww.
Only reason that plan was scrapped was because Castro canceled the trip that they planned on doing that with. Of course, you know, Castro had his trademark cigars, and there were many plans to poison his cigars, lace them with LSD, with depilatory stuff so his hair would fall out, and even, you know, put explosive devices on the Three Stooges.
Right. Make his beard fall out and the cigar explode on him.
Yeah. But it just keeps going. Exploding seashells to put on the beach, because Castro liked to go diving. They wanted to, on that same idea, they wanted to poison his diving suit. This one doesn't sound not that far-fetched. A poison pin that would have had a small needle at the top. It was like a Papermate ballpoint that you had to click, and that it would have like a small needle on the part that you click with your thumb. Yeah. They were all over the place.
And so all these were in the book, or these are just different things that you tried? Like,
yeah, if you look through the official manual, it's got like the first maybe third of it is actually like a preface. Maybe it's like the first fourth of the book is just it's like commentary where the author is H. Keith Melton and Robert Wallace, but they kind of go through a brief history of, you know, different...
Oh, God, it's like when you're trying to get a recipe and they're telling you their life story.
Right. They do that for search engine optimization. They're just trying to get their website and the Google results. But yeah, it is annoying. I'm like, what? Well, if you're only doing it for search engine optimization, put that stuff at the bottom.
Yeah.
Like, clearly mark, here's the recipe in big bold letters. Because you don't actually need the audience to read all of that crap. Some of the other devices that the TSS came up with, there is the Jack in the Box. This was a device. So, you know, sometimes they would, especially in Moscow, CIA officers would be, you know, the KGB was legendary for being able to identify and surveil U.S. spies. So they had to find ways to, you know, trick them. So one of the things that they'd often have to do is drop a person, like, you know, take someone somewhere and drop them off so they could go do something, but do that without the KGB realizing that the person had been dropped off. So they built this thing called a jack-in-the-box. So the idea is you've got a driver in the car and then another person in the passenger seat. They're driving along a path, regular, you know, hum-de-doo, nobody's following us, I'm sure. And they'll make a right turn. And so when they make a right turn, they've got like a few seconds of a gap where they can't be seen. So the idea is the person in the passenger seat rolls out of the car and then I guess, you know, jumps into an alley or something. And in their seat is a suitcase, and they pull a trigger on the suitcase and a fake head and shoulders pop up. And it
safety man. Like
a little, yeah. And it had a little grip gun that the driver could squeeze to make the person, make the fake person's head turn. That was kind of interesting.
A little detail.
One of my favorites, of course, they made, there's the suicide coin that the pilots for the U-2 spy plane will carry, which was, it was like a half dollar, or maybe it was a Roosevelt dollar coin that had a little needle hidden in it, and they could push on a spot on the coin, and the needle would pop up, and it would have a dose of cyanide. I don't think it was ever used, but they had it, just in case you want to kill yourself. Another thing that they developed, TSS developed, was a hidden radio so that pilots could, if they got captured, they could radio out to let people, let the CIA know where they were. And the radio was concealed in a fake scrotum. So they would make a custom scrotum to match their pilot's skin tone and everything, and they would wear it, with the idea being that the Russians wouldn't want to fondle their balls when they searched them.
So, well, somebody did not do their research, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you think that the Russians have no scruples, then you gotta assume that they're gonna. One of my favorites, though, was the Spy's Leather Man. This is from the book. The CIA created an escape and evasion suppository as a portable toolkit packed within a waterproof black plastic shell. This Spy's Leather Man featured 9 escape tools, including wire cutters, pry bar, saw blades, drill, and reamer, packed into the 4-inch long by 1-inch diameter kit. And there's a picture of it in the book, but it looks like a good news. It's a suppository. It's a 4-inch long suppository. I put it in their prison pocket. So, you know, those are just some of the things that the technical services staff cooked up on their own.
I have to wonder what was going on in their minds with some of this.
I mean, like I said, no bad ideas. You know, it's brainstorming. Let's hear them all. And then, you know, as we've mentioned before, when the CIA was first formed, they had a bottomless budget. They could spend as much money as they wanted. So they were like, why not? Yeah. Why not build a fake scrotum with a radio in it? So, all right, so back to the manual. The first manuscript delivered in 1954 was called Some Applications of the Art of Deception. This was Gottlieb invited Mulholland to suggest how the CIA might appropriate, quote, techniques and principles employed by magicians, mind readers, etc., to communicate information and the development of new non-electrical communication techniques. So, and that's from the book as well. Mulholland's work for TSS continued until 1958, when his failing health from constant smoking and advancing arthritis limited his ability to travel and consult, end quote. Which is going to come into play later, because so Mulholland was a heavy smoker, as was, you know, I guess almost everybody at the time. And as we'll see, a lot of the tricks that he came up with involved smoking. So, a lot of the tricks involved how to dose a person with a tablet or a powder or a liquid. And so a lot of that involved striking a match so that you could, you know, if there may, maybe you have a pill attached to the back of a matchbook that you could drop into someone's drink, or maybe the smoke from the match will distract a person so you can do something else while their attention is diverted. And they actually had to, like, develop new tricks as time went on and more people were non-smokers. So
you gotta smoke for your country.
Yeah. Mulholland also describes how that an agent could develop facial expressions to make themselves appear dumb. So there was some acting involved in this, which, you know, makes sense because magicians often have to act. He wrote in the manuscript, quote, "A sudden alertness on the part of the performer causes wariness on the part of the spectator. The opposite of an alert appearance is a stupid one. Assuming a mildly stupid appearance during a trick will give the appearance of disinterest. Naturally, this should be done to a mild degree, for suddenly having an imbecilic expression also is warranted to attract attention. Stupidity in appearance is affected by relaxing the facial muscles and throwing the eyes out of focus. To learn to relax the facial muscles, one should practice in front of a mirror." So that's just a little snippet. What's that?
Just how to look dumb.
Yeah.
Encourage, was that Art of War? You know, you want to encourage your enemy to underestimate you?
Yes. He also described methods to hide and deliver tablets, also how to deliver powders. One method for powders involved removing the rubber eraser from a pencil and hollowing out a section of it so you could pull the eraser out and drop the powder in somebody's drink or whatnot. Of course, he also uncovered hiding and delivering liquids as well, which would be especially helpful for MKUltra officers trying to dose people with LSD. Some of these delivery methods used a wallet or other everyday items, but like I mentioned earlier, a lot of them relied on cigarettes. These methods included small liquid containers and matchbooks in the end of cigarettes, and there's even they have drawings of a lot of the things in the book. There's even a specially made cigarette pack that would have a container inside of it of liquid with a little spray nozzle on its bottom. He also covered pickpocketing techniques, and I guess what you'd call reverse pickpocketing techniques, where an agent could plant an item, maybe a small listening device, on a target. Another thing I found interesting was he wrote a fair amount in the first manuscript about women and how female agents, need to adapt the tricks or, you know, maybe come up with different methods. Mulholland writes about how women can use men's assumptions about them to their advantage. Like a man assuming a woman can't readily understand complex situations or that a woman isn't capable of certain types of deception. He points out that it's often easier for a woman to play dumb because men are already primed to believe that they're dumb. He also notes that male agents should take special care when trying to deceive women because they're more likely to think ahead, whereas a male target is more likely to be engrossed in whatever actions the agent is performing in the moment.
Women are smart, guys. Harder than you.
Right. Yeah. There's definitely some instances, because this book was written in 1953. So there are some instances where he falls into the same trap that he mentions of underestimating women or making assumptions about them. But at the same time, he points out that, like, he's like, from personal experience, I can tell you that women are not nearly as stupid as men seem to think they are. He's written some of the, here's some of his writings on women. Quote, Women are not as apt to slouch in their chairs as are men, and so do not have to worry about having to avoid that attention or resting weakness. But women do fidget, even though they have their own way of doing so. Constantly patting hair, feeling earrings, or similar feminine actions attract attention to the individual and should not be done. On the notion of men being not as smart as women, he said, quote, "While the pose of lack of knowledge will be readily accepted as fact by a man, such a pose is apt to be suspected by another woman. This point is also true of a show of coyness, shyness, or maidenly modesty. A man will accept almost any degree of such ruses, while another woman will work more doggedly to satisfy herself of the correctness of her opinion. Even when a man is suspicious, he still may be readily tricked. It is infinitely more difficult to succeed with a trick before a suspicious woman. The obvious answer is, don't do anything to make the woman suspicious." He also points out that women's accessories, like their makeup and purse, give them more opportunities for hiding devices. But he warns against women using some of the tricks that he developed for men, because the actions required to mask those might be considered unfeminine, like, say, lighting someone else's cigarette. And that sounds a little sexist, but it's actually probably true for the time, you know, where it would seem unwomanly for a woman to, or maybe a little forward for a woman to offer a cigarette.
The whole point is to not cause undue attention to yourself. Do anything that's outside of the normal behavior for the day. Well, there you go, you know.
Right. In his second work, Recognition Signals, Mulholland describes different ways strangers who need to communicate without talking might signal their presence. These included carrying a package and even like how you tape the package or wrap or tie the package up. He made diagrams of different ways to use tape or, you know, string to communicate different messages. How somebody might organize the pins in their front coat or shirt pocket, assuming they're a nerd who carries pins in their pocket.
Like, three pins and means you're up for anything.
Yeah. And even how people lace their shoes. He had diagrams for different ways that you might lace your shoes to communicate information, you know. So the idea is not necessarily that people would talk, but different ways that two people might signal things to one another without actually doing so overtly. MKUltra was ended in the 60s. Gottlieb concluded, quote, "It has become increasingly obvious over the last several years that the general area of biological and chemical control of human behavior has less and less relevance to current complex operations. On the scientific side, these materials and techniques are too unpredictable in their effect on individual human beings to be operationally useful." So, you know, they killed MKUltra partly because they started to realize, hey, we could get in trouble for this, and partly because Gottlieb finally, after like 10 years, admitted that it was stupid, that, you know, there wasn't much operational potential from dosing people with LSD. And we'll definitely cover Sidney Gottlieb at some point. But yeah, he was obsessed with mind control and was convinced that the solution to it was acid. In 1973, Richard Helms had almost all of the records of MKUltra destroyed. For nearly 25 years, the story, the deception manuals, were nearly forgotten until a well-researched article by magic historian Michael Edwards appeared in Genii magazine in 2001, a follow-up August 2003 piece by Richard Kaufman in Genii, and a biography of Mulholland by magician Ben Robinson was published in late 2008 under the title Magician, with CIA capitalized in Magician, John Mulholland's Secret Life. So basically, you know, this manual was commissioned, both of these two manuals were commissioned by Gottlieb, and Mulholland worked with the CIA until he wasn't able to in 1958. And then once MKUltra was nixed and everything was burned, it was forgotten. And a lot of CIA agents, like, there were rumors about the manuals, but so few people had seen them that they didn't know for sure. And so it was just kind of like a myth among CIA officers, you know, like, oh, I heard that they have, they have these manuals that they hired a magician to write. And a lot of agents didn't believe that they existed. And then people started finding actual references to them and other CIA documents that were declassified. And then in 2007, H. Keith Melton, the author of the official CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception, was pouring through CIA records for something else completely unrelated. And he came across an overly Xeroxed, degraded copy of both of these manuscripts, which you could imagine if you, like, you know, you're a CIA researcher and you know that there are rumors that this exists, and then all of a sudden you find them, he probably cracked his pants. But yeah, when they found them, they were like poorly Xeroxed. They couldn't read a lot of it because, you know, the words were old and illegible. But yeah, so now we have the manual, thanks to H. Keith Melton, who's written a lot of books on CIA history, and he likes to focus on, like, the spy craft, the technical side of things. He's written a bunch of books like U.S. Government Guide to Surviving Terrorism, compiled from official U.S. government documents, Spy's Guide, Office Espionage, The Ultimate Spy Book, CIA Special Weapons and Equipment, Spy Devices of the Cold War, Spy University and Detective Academy. So, you know, this kind of this guy's wheelhouse. It's an interesting read. It's an interesting piece of the CIA's history. So, you know, if you're into that the way we are, then you might check it out. We obviously just skimmed through it. There's a lot of good stuff in there. When you get into the actual manuals, the manuscripts written by Mulholland, it's a little dry. but there's some interesting stuff in there. It's also a nice little period piece that gives you some insight into how people thought in that era. So yeah, that's the CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception. And I'm interested in reading some other CIA manuals.
Where can we find it? Where are you posting it?
Well, like I said, well, you can get the book on Amazon or, you know, wherever you order books. It's still in print. Like I said before, we'll have the link up on the website where you can download a digital copy for free. And yeah, I've been looking at you can find other declassified CIA manuals online. I've got some that I've been watching on eBay that I've been scared to actually buy because they're like CIA manual on improvised explosive devices and stuff. I'm like, I'm curious to read that, but I'm also, I don't want to end up on, you know, an NSA watch list. Of course, we're already on it, aren't we, NSA? No, you're listening.
Yeah, you mentioned, Abe and assassination gun. I heard assassination and gun. And you hear the clicks.
They're on us now. If you're listening, go ahead and subscribe. NSA officers, CIA officers, do us a solid and subscribe. You know, we could really use the listener numbers.
It's not fair if you listen and don't subscribe.
That is true. It's one thing if you just listen to one episode and, you know, you're like, okay, that was all right, but I don't feel like subscribing. That's fine. But if you're listening regularly, subscribe. Maybe even give us a review, a rating. I'd love to get a rating from an NSA officer or CIA officer. I'd be really interested to see what they have to say. And same thing for you guys, all you civilian listeners out there. Like, subscribe, rate, review, all that great stuff. We love it. It really helps us out. And you can follow us on our socials, twitter.com/CIA Files Podcast, Instagram @CIA Files, facebook.com/CIA Files. And of course, I mentioned our lovely website, CIAfiles.net. And I'd be remiss if I didn't give it one more mention to our upcoming project, The Rise of Mammon, wherein we try to document the rise of radical right-wing Christian authoritarianism. What I've started calling them nationalist Christians, but you can also call them Nazis for short. Did you get it? You get that?
Yep. Nazis.
It sounds like Nazis.
Yeah, but well, it sounds like Southern. The Nazis.
Nazis. Yeah. So that's a big concern. I don't want to get into that now because we're about out of time. But yeah, so keep a lookout for that. And thanks again for listening. And, you know, keep your bellies full. Keep your head on a swivel. Watch out for bad stuff, I guess. I don't know. I'm out of steam.
All right. You guys have a good day and a good week.
Yeah. See ya.